Well, I thought to emulate Don and race up those steps, but my racing up steps days is probably in the past. After 43 years of living in Temple Terrace, I think that I can safely say I have a long and pleasant association with the congregation here at Temple Terrace. Though I have never been a regular member here, I have certainly had frequent opportunities to worship with you. And of course, I have deep and long-term personal relationships with so many of you. But because of our time constraints, it would be inappropriate to get involved in public reminiscing about the relationships that I've had with so many of you familiar faces as I look out this evening. We are turning our attention, of course, to the issue of raising godly children in a godless culture. And as we turn our attention to that topic, I am mindful of what the crusty older member said about the young preacher when he began to preach about families. Now right there's where he left off preaching and started in on meddling. And of course, unfortunately this evening, I don't have the privilege of preaching first and then leaving off that to meddle. I just jump right into the meddling part of the sermon. And we think about this issue of raising children, and someone comes to us and speaks to us about the things that are most personal to us. There's always some consternation about exactly what that speaker's attitude or motivation is. And I can tell you that I approached the topic with considerable humility, and as I used to say when I preached on the topic, when I was a meddling younger preacher, there are only two kinds of preachers who ought to be preaching by this topic: those who are young enough not to have any children yet, and those who are fortunate enough to be older and their children are all grown and have moved out of town. And so I understand that when I speak on a topic like this, many of you, of course, will want to think about how well I have applied some of these principles myself, and I suggest, with humility, probably not as well as I wish that I had or that I should have. The one really great contribution that I made to the well-being of our children was the very wise choice I made of picking Wanda out and pursuing her and convincing her to become my wife and the mother of my children. So with that kind of appropriate introduction, I think, about the topic and my attitude about that, let me suggest to you some of the things that I hope will be useful to you as you consider this issue of how to raise godly children in a godless society. One of the things that frequently comes up when people talk about this question, is it harder to raise godly children today than it has been in the past? And most everybody will affirm that that's the case, that we live in much more difficult times. But then you give some consideration to the fact about those Christian families in Corinth in the first century and that godless city in which they were trying to raise godly children. Or think back even further to the Israelites in the land of Canaan, surrounded by those Canaanite people, those pagans that they should have run out of the country, and yet they left them there to be a negative influence on their own children. Or think back even to the first family, Adam and Eve, in which their firstborn rose up and slew their secondborn child. We all feel to some extent that these are the worst times, or the best of times, depending upon what the subject matter is, as Charles Dickens introduced his famous novel, A Tale of Two Cities. Of course, as we think about this issue of raising godly children in a godless world, we do recognize the difficulty principally seems to be the intersection of the dependency and the needs of children with the selfishness of modern parents, certainly in the society in which we live today. That's become much more of a difficulty. The dependency of children, because of the prolonged period of adolescence in which they're training for adult status in society, because of the increasing freedom that they have in a technologically sophisticated world, and the increasing kind of selfishness that we all face as a result of the indoctrination of the culture that we live in. And so I want to frame the lesson this evening in terms of this question: the obligations that parents have to their children. What do parents owe to their children when they brought them into the world? We have, in fact, of course, sometimes heard a child say to their parent, surely not your own children, but a child would say to their parent, I didn't ask to be born. And of course, they have the right of it there. Had they had the opportunity to ask, they probably would have asked to be born. But it is true to some extent that we brought them into the world, and when we do that, we shoulder the responsibility and the obligations to that child. And what do we owe to that child? First thing I would suggest, a fundamental starting place, is we owe them the right kind of attitude. We need to think about them in the right way. Ask parents today, why do you have children? And very frequently, the response that you would get would be something pragmatic, like, for instance, to carry on the family name, or to provide support for us in our old age. Or maybe they give it a little more serious thought and they come up with some response like, well, because it's fun to have children. And of course, all of those things, pragmatic or selfish, are not the kind of attitudes that the Bible suggests that we ought to have when we think about having children. The Bible suggests that, in fact, what we ought to think about in having children is that they are from the Lord. They are a blessing. And if you know a young couple that have tried to have children and have not been blessed with having children of their own, then you recognize at that moment what it means to think of them as a blessing from the Lord. Behold, the psalmist says, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. And as typical of most Bible passages, that packs a whole lot of meaning into that single verse. But what I would like for us to focus on is to recognize this when we think about our children. They are a reward. They are a blessing. They are the means by which God makes us able to stand without being ashamed before our neighbors. They are our heritage. You think about what that means, a heritage. We stand between the generation that came before and the generation that comes after. The children that we bring into the world and that we raise are going to be the message that we leave to the world about our own lives when we are gone. Someone once challenged by saying, if you could write a single sentence, or maybe a paragraph, or maybe a book that would represent you after you had passed on, what would you write? And you think about the care with which you would put into that, the kind of consternation you would experience about how to say things or what would you choose to say. But the truth of the matter is, we have already written, if we are parents, that letter, or are writing it if we are in the process of raising our children now. The Apostle Paul writes about those who were his children in the faith in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 2, and he says, you are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by all men. I've had the privilege of working at Florida College for these 44 years, and in that period of time, I have seen families that have brought their children, and then the grandchildren have come. And as you see the heritage, you see the record that is being written, for better or worse, you recognize the significance of this. That in fact it is our children who are going to live on after us to represent what we have done with our lives. You could never say, I think, of a person that they were a success in life if their children were not successful. If they didn't provide for their children and raise them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, then that's one of the great failures in their lives. You think about Eli and his children, Samuel, the great prophet, and his children, David, the man after God's own heart, and his children, and you have to recognize the failure, the enormous failure in the lives of those men. One of the things that I admire about Noah, despite the fact of living in a godless society, so godless that in fact God brought an end to it with a flood, was he at least saved his own children and the wives of his sons. And what is it that could crown our old age more than our children and our grandchildren? When we were first raising our children over on Glen Ridge Avenue across the street, there was a couple who had no children, and apparently deliberately had no children. Two alone was the vanity plate they had on the back of their sports car. And I wonder frequently these days, 40 years later, where they are and what their life is like, how impoverished it must be. I don't care how much money you accumulate. I don't care what kind of fame you might have in business or in academics. If you don't have children and grandchildren around you in your old age, then you are in many ways impoverished. This is the heritage that God has given for us. And what more difficult task could there be than the raising of children in a godly way? There is a lot of difficult tasks that you might undertake. A lot of skilled craftsmen here who have lots of different skills and lots of different ways. The technology that surrounds us requires an astuteness of mind and a capability. And we marvel at those who are able to do that kind of work, whether it's the actual hands-on with the computers or whether it's the programming. We admire those who are able to work with steel, or those who are able to work with porcelain, or those who are able to work with words and write sonnets. But what could be more difficult or more important than the raising of children? In fact, when we think about our children, we recognize that's one of the most important tasks that we will ever undertake. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus brings the child in front of them, and he says, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me." You receive me when you receive this child. And of course, he's talking in some more general kind of setting. But surely that applies to the fact that God has blessed us with children and we receive them as if we are receiving him. Too often in the United States of America today and in many other places around the world, children are not valued as they ought to be. They are valued by parents sometimes for the wrong reason. They're valued because of the status that the parents can achieve through their children. They want their children to be the athlete that they weren't, or maybe that they were. They want their child to be popular the way they weren't, or they want their child to be an academic. They want their child to achieve things so that somehow they live their lives through them. That's not really what children are all about. And that's not what's important about raising a child, that they can represent you in those kinds of ways. What's important is that they represent you in the future as a godly person, whatever their choice may be of an occupation. I know my former students probably would remember this, the example I always use. Parents say, accountancy, that would be a great career. You can earn a good, stable living for that. And the child wants to be a bassoonist. If they want to be a bassoonist, you know, they ought to give them the opportunity to play a bassoon. maybe they will figure that out. But if it's honorable before God and man, then that's not really the key issue in raising children. We need to have the right attitude to appreciate them. Martin Luther's teacher, it is said, when he walked through the village, gruff and cynical and snide with all of the adults, and when he would come to children, he would bow before them and speak kindly to them. And folks would say, "Why are you so gruff with the adults and so kind to the children?" And he would look at them and he would say, "Well, it's apparent already what you are, but it's not yet apparent what these children could be." He recognized the value of the potential in those children. We need to have the right attitude. And we need to provide to our children, we have an obligation to provide them with security. The security of a stable home. Children, because of their dependency, need to feel surrounded with love and protection. And of course, the difficulty of that is getting it exactly right. I can only resort to the old image of holding a bar of wet soap. You don't hold it, it will slip out of your hand. But you squeeze it too hard and it will squirt out of your hand. You got to hold the child in exact. They've got to have enough protection so they feel secure, but not so much that they feel hedged in and bound up. You have to pay attention to their physical security. One of the things that we need to be careful of with children is the delicacy of their young and their growing physique. And of course, we're much more cognizant of that these days with seatbelt laws and not shaking the child and holding them carefully. We need to provide them physical security. We need to help them overcome their fears. We need to take their fears seriously when in fact they are upset about something that might happen to them. We need to pay attention to their mental security. Even if it comes to the point, I would suggest, of getting out the flashlight and looking under the bed to make sure there's no danger lurking there during the night while they're sleeping. We need to take their fears seriously. Young people see the world as a magical place. They don't see it in the same way that we do. And it's just like amazing when every once in a while you have one of those kind of glimmers of insight. I remember my oldest told me after he was, and they tell you so many things after they're grown that you wish you had known at the time, but he was telling me, you know, we drive down the highway with the windows open and the wind blowing in, and as it blows through, there's one of these paper bags that's kind of rotating around in the footboard, and then psst, out the window it goes. And he said he was so terrified that he was going to be blown out of the window too. And you just don't even stop to think about those things. They don't think to tell you about that. The only person who ever really understood that about children was Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers would sing, "You can never go down, never go down, never go down the bathtub drain." And who would think to reassure children of that? But they have a need for that kind of reassurance, that kind of emotional security. One of the best lessons I think we ever learned, our oldest child was premature. And of course, fortunately for us, in some ways, it was our eldest because we didn't have anything to compare it to. He is like 4 pounds when we brought him home from the hospital. And we thought that's just the way babies were. And, you know, we were worried about all those things new parents do. Should you feed on demand? Should you let them cry themselves to sleep? At what age should you do all of those kind of things? And we were blessed to be at a congregation with some older women who were able to fulfill the admonition that Paul gave to Timothy to teach the younger women to love their husband, love their children. And they said, "You hold that baby and you rock that baby and you cuddle that baby and you give him all the kindness and love that you can." They need that kind of security. They need that. And you know what they need most of all? Physical, mental, emotional security. What they need is the security of a happy marriage around about them. When they hear the bickering and they feel the tension, that destroys the kind of security that God intended for them to have in the family. Remember that when the spouses are unhappy, their children are going to have a hard time feeling the kind of happiness that we owe them. This old doggerel piece suggests it very well. The family is like a book. The children are the leaves, the parents are the cover, which full protection gives. Love is the golden clasp that binds it all in all. Oh, break it not, lest all the leaves be scattered and be gone. One of the greatest tragedies in America today is the divorce that separates husband and wife from one another and leaves children in a broken home in which they can't have the kind of security that we owe them. If you want to talk about inequality in America, whether you want to talk about it in terms of educational inequality or economic inequality, I can tell you where the problem is, and the problem is in the difference between single-parent households and parent intact households, where children grow up with the security of both parents who love one another and love them. We owe them our affection. We're given that model in the New Testament when Jesus uses the kind of affection that parents are supposed to have for their children to explain to us the affection that God has for us. What man is there among you who, if his son asked for bread, would give him a stone? Or if he asked for a fish, he would give him a serpent? I have no idea about what the emotional texture is of Jesus' sermons to the crowds. But I almost get the sense here that he has gone to this kind of hyperbole, this kind of exaggeration, and paused enough. Either their chuckles or their hurried whispers around, surely that could never happen. Parents don't treat their children that way. At least parents ought not to have to treat their children that way. They ought not to do that. But so many parents do that inadvertently, if not deliberately. You shouldn't have to say to parents you need to love your children. Not when you see them with their newborn and it's new and they're so happy. But the new wears off and the parents seem to forget that affection. That's why Paul instructed Titus to tell the older women to teach the younger women to love their husbands and to love their children. Because people don't have that just natural sort of instinct, as we sometimes have said in the past. We have to learn how to do that. We have to learn how to practice the love and the affection that is due to a spouse and the love and affection that is due to a child. And parents will say, well, of course we love them. They ought to know that. Well, of course, that's what husbands sometimes say about their wife. You know, she ought to know I love her. You don't ever tell me you love me anymore. Well, I told you that when we got married, and if I change my mind, I'll let you know. That ought to be good enough. That's not good enough, and it's not good enough for the children either. How do they know that we love them? We may say it in a variety of ways. We may give them gifts and think that says, I love you. We may take time with them, and those are good things, but we need to communicate it to them. You know, one of the problems that we have very frequently in the relationships we have with those people that are most important to us is what's called conditional regard. The implication of the message, whether we say it outright or not, is, I will love you if. And particularly, parents communicate that message to their children. I'll love you if you don't get in trouble. I'll love you if you take care of your chores at home. I'll love you if you get good grades. I'll love you if you're successful in athletics. I will love you if. No wonder teenagers suffer such pangs of self-doubt in the world in which we live today. We need to communicate to them in such a way that they understand it without any doubt that we love them. And you know what? They need love, especially when they least deserve it. Just as in our relationship with God. For God demonstrates his love toward us, even though while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So we need to communicate to our children that we love them, even when maybe they're at their worst and misbehaving. Loving them, providing affection to them, means treating them with respect. We don't need to be treating them with sarcasm or ridicule or rudeness. We need to treat them with some kind of minimum kind of a courtesy. Exercising parental authority can be done with some kind of dignity, even when the child is being rebellious. You wouldn't want a judge who is a screaming harpy, like some parents are when they find their children have been disobedient. We need to have our affection show through even in those moments. We also owe our children our time and our companionship. Sometimes, of course, parents try so hard to give their children all the advantages of various kinds of extracurricular activities, or putting them in private schools, or buying the best kind of clothes for them, and they forget probably the more valuable thing they can give to their children is their time and their companionship. Maybe that's a part of what Samuel's problem was with his children. Even though he'd seen what happened to Eli's sons, he rode that circuit. 1 Samuel 7 and verse 16 tells us, from year to year he rode on that circuit judging the people of Israel. And then in 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3, we read that his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gains, took bribes, perverted justice. Why? I don't know the entirety of that story, but I suggest it was because he didn't invest the time in them that he needed to have invested in them. Some studies try and keep track of, with diaries or videos or interviews, how much time that parents actually spend with their children. And after we get past the age of preschool and looking at parents in typical middle class households, parents spend 10 minutes a day actually directly interacting with their children in other ways than scolding them or reminding them or telling them what they need to do. And some people will say, I spend all day at work and try and pay for all of this stuff, and you mean I have to come home when all that's over and play games with the kids too? Well, yes, that's exactly what's expected of you. You brought them into the world and you owe them that. You may remember the song by Sandy and Harry Chafin, Cats in the Cradle. My child turned 10 just the other day, and he said, "Thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me how to throw?" And I said, "Not today. I got a lot to do." And he said, "That's okay." And he walked away. His smile never dimmed. And he said, "I'm going to be just like him." Yeah, you know I'm going to be like him. And it's long years since I retired and my sons moved away. And I called him up just the other day and I said, "I'd like to see you if you don't mind." And I said, "I'd love to, Dad, if I could find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids have the flu, but it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you." And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. We need to spend time with them. And spending time with them doesn't mean that we give up our paternal status in order to be their buddy. I won't read the whole thing. I have a letter here, ostensibly from Ricardo Montalban to his son. Ricardo Montalban, The Wrath of Khan, for those of you who don't remember that. But I was struck by this letter because he begins and says, "As long as you live in this house, son, you're going to obey my rules. When you have your own house, you can make your own rules." He said, "I have an obligation to perform the role of a father. I'm not your pal. Our ages are too different. We can share many things, but we're not pals. I'm your father." And this is 100 times better than what any pal is. We have the obligation to spend time with them in the appropriate way. And it doesn't have to be big or important things. There's a story told about ambassador from the United States to Britain. Kept a journal, as some of those important men did in the previous century. And his son, following his example, had his own diary. And you look at this one day in which they have a common entry. And the father writes, "Wasted the day, went fishing with my son." And then you read the son's entry. And he says, "Went fishing with my dad, best day of my life." There's a world of difference in the way in which they see the things that we do with them And we need to spend that time with them. In the past, when women first started working and not spending time at home, they created this justification, this idea that we can spend quality time with our children instead of quantity time. If we make the time quality enough, it will make up for the fact that we don't have a quantity of time with them. Yeah, you try and make an appointment with a child and spend quality time with them on your schedule. Doesn't work out quite as well as we think it might. And one of the things we've got to do is we need to listen to them as well as tell them things. God listens to us. He has given us 67 books in which He's written to us. But how many innumerable hours of prayer has He listened to? How many passages invite us to come and speak to Him and approach the throne of grace? We need to listen to our children as well as tell them things. You know, sometimes they got important things to tell us. And listening to them is critical to knowing what's going on in their lives. It's more important, perhaps, than even what you have to say. Sometimes parents of older children complain and they say, "My child never tells me anything." Well, you didn't establish when they were younger the pattern of talking and listening to that child. One of my fondest memories is when I'd come home from school, my mother would have milk and cookies and we would sit in the kitchen and she would talk to us and ask us about our day. And because we had that pattern, that habit, we continued to talk with her even as we got older and grown. Your children don't talk to you because you haven't established the habit about that. And maybe when they talk, you don't even listen to them. Did you listen when they had something to say? I had a conversation with a man just not too long ago, and he was telling him about his issues with his son. And he was telling me what this conversation that had. And he told me in great detail about what he said and what he thought about saying and what he was going to say and didn't say, but what he really did say. And I said, "Well, what did your son say?" And he had some kind of vague idea about that, but he didn't know what his son had said. He had not really listened to him. You know, we need to listen to what they have to say. And sometimes when they talk to us, especially when they get to be teens, what they say doesn't seem all that meaningful. Doesn't seem like they even understand it themselves. And they need as much help as they possibly can get at that time of talking with them and listening to them and trying to help them understand it themselves. We need to listen as well as just talk to them. And we need to provide them with the right kind of example. Given the natural tendencies of life, children are unlikely to be much better than their parents are without some extraordinary intervention from somewhere else. When my dad would hear one of his children praised, he used to jokingly say, "It's not much of a man who can't raise up a son better than himself." And I listened to that as a child and just took it, you know, that's what my dad was saying. But now I think I would say, you know, it's quite a man that can raise children better than himself. You have to give them the right example. The quality of the parents is going to approximate to a considerable extent the quality of the child. It was Schweitzer, I think, who said, "Example is not the best teacher, it's the only teacher." You try and teach a child something, and then you don't follow that pattern yourself. And in fact, one of the things you're going to recognize is that your lessons were kind of in vain. One man used to tell me that he told his sons, "You can use any language that you hear me use." And that's a pretty daunting principle, especially if we extend that to the issue of topics and tone. We need to provide them with the right example. In fact, we need to also recognize the necessity of disciplining our children. But we can't discipline our children if we don't discipline ourselves. The crux of the problem for most parents is not the issue of whether you're in charge of your children, but are you in charge of yourself? You can't expect them to perform better than the example that you provide for them. When we talk about disciplining children, and you knew I'd get to this, probably, let's see, are we coming back Thursday evening for second half of this lesson? Let me quickly suggest some fundamental principles about discipline. Discipline is not just about punishment. Really, there are two sides to the issue of discipline, whether it's church discipline or whether it is the discipline of children. There's instructive discipline, and then, of course, there is the necessity of punitive discipline. The word discipline comes, as you well know, from the same word from which we create disciple. Jesus discipled. He disciplined his followers to live the right kind of lives. That what we mean by discipline is the effort to generate in the child the right kind of character. And what that ultimately leads to is self-discipline. We don't just want to control the behavior of the child in this moment and in this circumstance, but we want to create in the child the ability to control himself as is appropriate for his age and as he matures ultimately to the point to be a self-disciplined adult. If we are not actively disciplining our children, then they're going to find other sources of instruction, of discipling, that other than that which we're going to give them. And there are two really kind of major problems here that you have to recognize if you're not correctly instructing your children. First of all is media indoctrination. And too many parents today are forced by circumstances, or they just allow the instruction of their children to be taken over by strangers, the babysitters or the schools or the TV or their peers. That really is going to instruct these children in the way in which they're supposed to live. We should not leave the instruction of children into the hands of strangers, even the hands of the brethren, probably. Especially, I would say, these two issues, sex and religion. It's our responsibility to instruct them. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verses 6 and 9. I don't know if you've ever been over to the college out on the bricks that have the engraving on them out underneath the big tree at the front next to Bullard. But there are a number of those bricks, and when the time came to buy those bricks, we were only able to afford a half of one. And but on that half of one, here's what we wrote, Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9. These words I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as a frontlet between your eyes. And you will write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. And some people, strangely enough, they want to wait till the child is old enough to make up his own mind about religious issues. It just doesn't make any sense in any area of life, but certainly not in the issue of the most important areas of life, our relationship to God. Mother asked the psychologist, when should I start training my child? And the psychologist said, well, how old is your child? And she said, 5. And his reply was, you better get up right now and get home because you've already wasted 5 years. Those are critical years too. The average child in America today spend 60 hours in front of screens every week. You may think that's a large number. Well, it is a large number. You may think that's an impossible number. You might want to check. 60 hours in front of screen time. That's 36 hours by the time they're 18. They will spend 15,000 hours in school. Twice as much in front of screens. By the time they have reached the age of 18, they probably have seen 18,000 murders, 6,000 rapes. That's a lot of instruction that you've got to counteract. You need to be spending time talking to them about the things that they're doing on the screens. And one of the things about the screen time is it's a lot more passive than a lecture is. It's a lot more passive than reading a book. And we talk with some concern in this society, at least that was one first lady's concern, about the crisis of obesity among children. But not only do we have the crisis of obesity among children, it creates a laziness of mind in which they have inability to read, an inability to listen to a lecture and understand it. I have seen over the last 40 years an increasing or a decreasing ability on the part of young people to listen to a 40-minute lecture. Maybe there is some benefit after all to these long sermons that our kids are exposed to as they grow up. One of the other things you have to be concerned about is the peer pressure. We have a generation that is more peer trained today than ever, due to, in some ways, to the separation of the parents and the children's world, but especially due to the kind of social media that broadens and strengthens the indoctrination of peers. By the time a child is 3, they already know what kind of shoes they should wear and what kind they should not. And certainly when they get to be teenagers, the fear of missing out and the concern about being accepted is just going to tear them in every single direction. They can't keep up with all the variety of social influences. What they need is they need parents to provide them with an understanding from an early age that they are different from the world around about them and that they can live their lives in a different way that is more worthwhile than the direction in which the world is leading them. They need to have some connection to their parents, and the closer the connection with the parents, the better able they are to heed Solomon's advice and to resist the peer pressure to engage in sinful behaviors. Children need to have that close relationship with their parents in which they understand who they are, independent of the various directions in which they're being pulled by the world around about them. One of the things that I think kind of overarches all of this, and I have to finish with this point, is the issue of love. I always fall back on this because we all make mistakes as parents. I have a hard time sometimes sitting at the table when my children are gathered around and reminiscing about when they lived at home. It's like so embarrassing, the mistakes that I made. But we can always find refuge, I hope, in this. The words of Peter, 1 Peter chapter 4, love covers a multitude of mistakes. If we love them, communicate that we love them, if we are focused on their good, whether in terms of the time we spend with them, the conversations we have with them, the discipline that we engage in, we may safely entrust to God the outcome, and we may safely send into the future the letters that are our heritage. May God bless us in our homes and in our children, and may, in fact, we be blessed in the Lord and be at home in heaven when this life is over. Thank you for your attention this evening.